Loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for Brian Becker, and joined in studio by John Kiriakou. In this hour, we take a look at several big stories. First, we go over the biggest news so far this week, including Congress's efforts to overturn Donald Trump's state of emergency declaration and the Kim Trump summit in Vietnam. And then we continue our regular segment Beyond Nuclear, where we look at nuclear issues, including weapons, energy, waste, and the future of nuclear technology in the United States.
But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines. Iranian President Hassan Rouhani has rejected the resignation of his foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, and instructed him to continue in his current position. Zarif apparently offered his resignation in outrage after he was kept out of the loop regarding a surprise visit by Syrian President Bashar al-Assad to Iran. His attempted resignation is also widely believed to be linked to intense domestic criticism over the nuclear deal signed with the United States and other world powers, which Zarif was a key architect of, but which has now been trashed by the Trump administration. Russia's Ministry of Defense today released a joint statement with the government of Syria, calling for the United States to pull its troops from Syria and to let buses safely relocate refugees at a camp in the Rukban area near the border with Jordan. President Trump has recently reversed his commitment to pull troops out of the country, announcing that 400 troops will stay in two parts of Syria. Senators introduced legislation yesterday to require the Director of National Intelligence to submit a public report of the incidents surrounding the death of Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi after President Trump missed a deadline set by Congress to do the same. Khashoggi was killed after entering a Saudi consulate almost 6 months ago. The Independent National Electoral Commission of Nigeria announced that Muhammad Buhari has won a second term as that country's president. Buhari won 56% of the vote, according to the commission. However, Atiku Abubakar of the opposition People's Democratic Party has rejected the result, claiming that his campaign was the victim of vote rigging. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
It's Wednesday, and that means it's time for our weekly segment In the News, where we take a look at the most important ongoing developments of the week and put them into perspective. We're joined from Washington by Jackie Lookman. She is the co-editor-in-chief of Lookman Nation. You can check out their live stream every week on Facebook and YouTube. Welcome back, Jackie.
Happy to be here. Thanks.
Let's start with the national emergency and the House resolution that was passed overturning it or seeking to overturn it. It now goes to the Senate. Tell us what's going on.
So the House has been working fervently behind the scenes to oppose or to end President Trump's national resolution or his national emergency, trying to declare a national emergency to divert funds from other agencies to be used to build his border wall. Again, we talked a couple of weeks ago about how only Congress it controls the purse strings of the budget. But somehow the president thinks that building a wall on the southern border to address a crisis that even the Department of Defense is saying doesn't exist is something that he can do. The Democrats who control the House have passed a resolution opposing the national emergency, which 13 Republicans have actually voted in support of. The 13 Republicans have voted to support the opposition to this resolution. Now this, the resolution to oppose the national emergency now goes to the Senate, in which three Republicans have said they will support that opposition to the national emergency. And I think they only need four votes to ratify this opposition. So we'll see what happens.
Jackie, relative to that, neither the House nor the Senate is going to be able to come up with the votes to override a presidential veto. So explain to me what political points the Democrats can score by passing these resolutions, even if the passage is not veto-proof.
I think the political points for them hold over to 2020, saying that they stood up to Trump and trying to implement this racist border wall. And it also, I think, for the Democrats, shows that they can push some Republicans to have some common sense response to Trump's bad policies. I think on the other side, though, that doesn't bode well for Republicans, because we know how the Republicans are very, Republican voters are very active in midterm elections, a lot more, unfortunately, than Democratic voters in midterm elections. And among Trump's base, those 13 Republicans who voted with the Democrats are now going to be the targets of primary campaigns to get rid of them in their upcoming midterms in the next few years. So they are already going to have to fight for their political lives. But I do think that for the Democrats, this is all political, because all Trump has to do is say, well, I'm just going to veto your resolution and continue to do what he wants. But it's all politics.
John Kiriakou, let's talk a little bit about the prospects for this resolution in the Senate. You know, even though, like, as we're saying, there's pretty much no chance that the that Congress will pass a veto-proof resolution overturning the national emergency, but it could still be, you know, highly politically impactful and symbolic if both houses do pass it.
Without a doubt. I think really the Democrats are using this vote as a marker, just to say in the next campaign, look, we thought this was a stupid idea. We passed a resolution saying so, and it was the president that vetoed it, and it was the Republican leadership in both the House and the Senate that encouraged their members to oppose it, and thus it was veto-proof. So I think it's really all about the politics. I don't think that Nancy Pelosi or Chuck Schumer ever expected from the very beginning that this would pass and become the law of the land. I think they did it just to score some political points.
Yeah, Jackie, I mean, there's three Republican senators who have said that they'd vote for it. That's Susan Collins in Maine, Lisa Murkowski of Alaska. You know, both of them are considered, you know, quote unquote centrist. There's also Tom Tillis of North Carolina, who said that he was opposed to the state of emergency. But I mean, when you really think about it, those are three people. I mean, Tom Tillis is a little bit unusual, but it's...
Yeah, Tillis is unusual.
Yeah, but it's still, I think, overall pretty remarkable how the Republican Party has remained relatively united behind Trump now, you know, almost 3 years into it. Well, you know, a little bit over 2 years into his presidency. People at the beginning, when Trump first took office in early 2017, were thinking that, you know, the Republican Party might abandon him at one point or another, but that certainly hasn't happened.
No, they couldn't abandon him because they hitched their ideological wagon to him. They supported the political wins that they got from his presidency, even though so many of them were appalled that he won the nomination in 2016. And they couldn't even believe it. A lot of the long-term established Republicans and a lot of the Republicans that even we wouldn't consider moderate Republicans today, they were pretty shocked that Trump won the nomination, but they won the White House. The Republicans won the White House, even if it's under this contemptible person in Donald Trump. So for the Republican Party, their political survival is tied to Trump. So they can't abandon him now. So it's really not a surprise that they haven't abandoned him. Not to me.
So, Jackie, let's turn on to another topic here. Of course, it's top news that Kim Jong-un, the leader of North Korea, and Donald Trump are meeting in Hanoi. It's a 2-day summit. They just, you know, wrapped up their first day of meetings. What are you looking at there? What do you think are the most important things that are going on?
I think this is, you know, just another kind of political posturing for Donald Trump. Look, if all of this brings an end to the decades long tension between North and South Korea, I think that's wonderful. That's great. For me, it's not a feather in the cap of Donald Trump. I think it is just something that Kim Jong-un was looking at having to do anyway, because North Korea was so isolated from really the rest of the world. But I think what is really going on with Trump's focus and attention on North Korea and heaping all this praise on Kim Jong-un after U.S. administration has, you know, demonized him as probably the most evil person on the planet, or the North Korean administration as the most evil government on the planet, is really in something Trump said that I think a lot of people missed. So Trump said that North Korea's economic potential is great and that he's excited to see where that would go. And that caused me to kind of look up what he's talking about, because we think of North Korea as like a barren kind of wasteland of a country where, you know, people have nothing to eat. But really, North Korea is apparently sitting on $6 trillion of natural resources to be mined: gold, tungsten, titanium. So for Trump, I think he's looking at North Korea, and all of these summits with North Korea really are about developing business interests and less about trying to work toward peace. Certainly, it's not going to be an into nuclear, North Korea's nuclear program.
Jackie, don't you think it's equally likely, though, that Donald Trump, being the narcissist that he is, just wants to win the Nobel Peace Prize?
Well, that too, because didn't someone just nominate him?
Well, he says that the Prime Minister of Japan nominated him.
Yeah, after he called him.
Exactly. After he called and asked.
Yeah, you know, Jackie, I think this is a really important factor. I mean, I also agree with what John's saying. I mean, I really do think that Donald Trump is, I mean, he's so narrowly motivated. The desire to win a Nobel Peace Prize, okay, that would be nice. But I think what he really, really wants to do is be president for an additional 4 years, right, after the 2020 election. And, you know, if he can point to this and be like, oh, I made the, it kind of goes along with his persona, right? Like, I'm the great deal maker. I did this thing nobody else could do.
Yeah.
Obama couldn't do it. None of the other presidents for the last 60 years could do it. But I really agree with the point that you're making. I think it's important because, you know, it's one of the cruelties of the division of the Korean Peninsula that, you know, the North and South, they're, you know, they make up one sort of economic whole. So the North is more mountainous. It has a lot of these very valuable mineral resources that you're talking about. But by virtue of being more mountainous, there's a lot less arable land that can be used for agriculture. That is mostly concentrated in the South, right? So, I mean, they're naturally complementary economies. I mean, it's been one civilization for, like, you know, millennia. It's really such an injustice from a lot of different angles that it's been split up, and reunification could really unleash its economic potential. Certainly, I think that's what Kim Jong-un wants to do. And the economic sanctions that North Korea has been under, especially since, you know, the fall of the Soviet Union and many of its other trading partners in Eastern Europe, the level of isolation that has been imposed on the North Korean economy is pretty remarkable. And it's also important to remember, like, that was actually the motivation, really. I mean, at least one of two primary motivations for the nuclear program. North Korea's guiding state policy used to be called, translates to, like, Army First. I've seen it translated. And so basically the idea is that we have to develop an enormous conventional army to deter an attack from the United States. Of course, that's tremendously expensive too, right? And so what Army First was replaced by a new policy called parallel development, which means on the one hand, we're going to develop a nuclear deterrent much, much, much cheaper than, you know, maintaining this giant standing army. And on the other hand, we're going to use the resources that frees up to develop the economy to try to alleviate the economic suffering that's been imposed on the country. So if he can, you know, maybe limit the nuclear program in some way and get further economic concessions, I mean, I think that goes right along with their strategy. I wanted to ask you about some of the reaction here in the United States, because if we go back, you know, 20, 30 years ago or whatever, there's this, like, concept of the liberal dove. You know, Democrats are supposed to be less bombastic, I guess is the way to say it, on the international stage. But the biggest critics of this, the people who are the most skeptical about the prospects for peace in Korea, appear to be the leadership of the Democratic Party.
Without a doubt.
Yeah, absolutely. Until, of course, they are going to be helped to realize how much money they can make from the reunification of the Korean Peninsula, then I bet you their tune will change. But I'm ever the cynic.
Well, this goes to the bankruptcy of our current political system, too, where the good of the country is not what comes first. The good of each individual political party is what comes first. Can you imagine, in the aftermath of the Second World War, one party opposing peace? You know, can you imagine what would have happened then with the Marshall Plan or the Truman Doctrine? The world would be a different place if we treated international affairs then like we treat them now.
It's unfortunate that so much of our politics, almost all of our politics in this country, really is tied to the individual prospects of wealth that our so-called elected officials either can realize or they can. It's really not about the betterment of people in this country and certainly not about improving the lives of people around the world. And I think we see that pretty clearly in the responses to this North Korea possible reunification.
Let's go on to another case. There's the case of Huda Mutana, who is a young woman who was born in the United States. She left when she was 19 years old. She left her family in Alabama to go to Syria to be part of ISIS. Now she's trying to return, but in a case that has huge constitutional implications, the Trump administration is trying to block her. We've been covering this on Loud and Clear. It's an extremely important case. Give us your take on it, if you would.
This, I think, ties directly to, Donald Trump's declaration that he is going to end birthright citizenship. This is literally the case the Trump administration has been hoping for in order to make the case that birthright citizenship is a bad thing and that it should be done away with. Because this young woman was born in this country, Huda Mutana was born in this country to someone who is, her father was a diplomat, but not at the time that she was born. By the time she was born, he was no longer working as a diplomat. So according to the 14th Amendment, she was born here. She is a citizen of this country. She was issued passports, U.S. passports, as a citizen. Yes, she did leave to go to Syria to join ISIS. She had a baby, I think, with a member of ISIS. She has an 18-month-old son seeking to return to the United States. But Trump instructed Secretary of State Pompeo to not allow her back into the country. So now she is suing the United States to come back. The interesting thing is that if she comes back to the United States, she knows that she will more than likely go to jail, that she will more than likely serve some kind of incarceration time. She'll be punished for her role in being involved in ISIS. That's not even an issue for her. The issue is that she is a United States citizen, according to the 14th Amendment, so she should be allowed to return to this country and face whatever legal punishment that this country decides she should face, because she is still under the jurisdiction of the laws of this country. The implications of this case are really frightening, because then that would overturn centuries of constitutional law that comes from the 14th Amendment that gave African Americans citizenship, because the Supreme Court under Dred Scott said that African Americans who were born here, who were formerly enslaved, were not citizens and never would be. So if that is overturned, now we're going back to a situation where the United States government is deciding on a case-by-case basis, who is and who is not a citizen. And like we just said, we're not dealing with a government that really is operating under the auspices of doing anything for the benefit of the people. So this is a really frightening case for me.
I think you're exactly right, Jackie. I think that the administration has bitten off more than it can chew here. Huda Mutana is going to prison if she comes back. And if you look at other similar cases where American citizens went overseas to fight, or where Americans or green card holders conspired against the United States in terrorism cases, she's probably looking at a sentence of somewhere around 20 to life. So why in the world the administration just doesn't let this American citizen back into the country and then prosecute her for crimes that she's alleged to have committed, rather than to make themselves look foolish by trying to illegally, unconstitutionally revoke the citizenship of a naturally born American, is a mystery to me. I don't know why they've decided to take on this fight. It makes no political sense.
Yeah, I agree. And again, where are the Democrats? Where is the so-called opposition party?
That's right.
Yeah, I mean, Huda Matana is somebody who's easy to demonize, you know, because she did join ISIS. I mean, she was very young. I mean, that's a whole different discussion. But what we're talking about here is the precedent that this sets, right? I mean, so I think what the Democrats are doing is that they think, oh, well, this is a, you know, a Muslim woman who joined ISIS. You know, we're not going to stick our necks out for her. You know what I mean? It's just, you know, they're making their own political calculation. But, you know, what's being ignored in all of this, but as we've been talking about, is quite clear, is that this sets a precedent whereby Donald Trump can, I mean, it's one of sort of like the foundational things of democracy in the United States. I mean, you know, you can make an argument about if the United States is a democracy, but I mean, certainly it was not a democracy prior to the passage of the 13th, 14th, and 15th amendments, which were sort of the end of the Civil War, abolition of slavery amendments. And so to get rid of birthright citizenship would open the door to a whole host of other, I mean, it's really terrifying, isn't it?
Yeah, it is very terrifying. And I think it needs to be made clear that this is obviously born out of Islamophobia, too. This whole targeting this young woman. Yes, ISIS is absolutely a problem. But this is claiming that a woman who was a Muslim before she left, but is still a United States citizen, doesn't get to be a United States citizen anymore, not because she went and joined ISIS, but because she's a Muslim. I mean, these are issues that we need to be very, very clear on, or else we really will be subjected to a terrible erosion of our rights as citizens, where somebody else gets to decide whether we're citizens or not based on whether they like what we do or how we worship. Or this is a horrible situation.
So I think we can move on now to our last topic of the segment. Of course, we've been covering Venezuela very, very closely. We know that's something that you've been paying a lot of attention to. What are the biggest things that have happened since we last spoke on Friday?
Well, Saturday, there was obviously this skirmish at the border where the United States basically manufactured this confrontation. And, you know, that's been covered quite a bit. But what wasn't covered, interestingly, was a massive rally that where Maduro spoke to what looked to me like tens of thousands of Venezuelans who were out supporting the continuation of the Bolivarian Revolution and opposing the United States trying to force what we're calling, our government is calling humanitarian aid, but is really just a cover for a regime change and a militarized coup, and also supporting a receiving aid from other countries and from the UN. But also, I think yesterday, Jorge Arreaza, Venezuela's foreign minister, called for direct talks between Maduro and Trump. Now, if Maduro is an evil dictator, why is he willing to talk to the president of the country that's been trying to overthrow him and is actively trying to stage a military coup against him right now? And the fact that this isn't being reported, obviously, in American media just speaks to the complicit nature of American media with a really wrong-headed United States government in regard to foreign policy and our support of regime change and normalizing the demonization of a democratically elected leader of another country.
Yeah, I mean, the Maduro administration, since it took office in 2013, has been very consistent about its desire to negotiate. There were negotiations with the opposition, with the Venezuelan opposition parties. They have a coalition that's sort of falling apart, but it's called the Democratic Unity Roundtable. They effectively reached an agreement in 2017 in the Dominican Republic. You know, there was an extensive agreement about how elections were to be organized. But at the very last moment, I mean, after everything had already been set, they were, you know, just getting ready for the signing ceremony. At the very last moment, the opposition pulled out. And clearly the reason for that is that somebody from the United States, reportedly Rex Tillerson, called the head of the opposition delegation and said, there is no deal. We're not going to be making a deal. So I think it makes a lot of sense that the Venezuelan government's position now is like, look, we'll just talk with the United States because we know that you guys are the ones who are in charge anyway. It's just a waste of time to be talking to your, you know, proxies. Like, why don't we just discuss directly? Because we know that you're calling the shots when it comes to the political actions of the opposition. So, Jackie, let's talk about this issue of humanitarian aid. The narrative, you know, like you're alluding to, is that, oh, well, you know, Maduro, the dictator, his people are starving, but he's willing to even, you know, injure and even kill people to keep out the humanitarian aid, part of that demonization process you were going on. But what's the real story?
Well, the real story is that other countries, China, Russia, Cuba, and other countries have actually provided Venezuela with more aid than the United States is actually claiming to try to send. So that is part of the narrative that's not being told. But the other part of the narrative that isn't being told is that private food processors and distributors are actually a part of the plan to destabilize the Maduro regime because they've been stockpiling food in order to manufacture this food shortage, this food crisis, and make it seem like Maduro is actually starving his people. And this is all a part of this whole narrative of socialism not working, but Venezuela doesn't really have a purely socialist economy or government. It does have some aspects of private corporate entities and some aspects of free market, but it's not enough for the private entities. So they want it all. They don't want most of the mineral and oil profits to be used, 70% of which to be used to support the people of Venezuela. So they want it all. So the media is not telling the truth in the United States about all of the aid that Venezuela is receiving from other countries, that the United Nations has even said that it is not going to support the United States trying to deliver humanitarian aid as a cover for political means to further destabilize and discredit the Maduro government. It's all a farce that is a cover for this military coup that the United States is trying to stage that is not going well for this government, by the way, in Venezuela.
Yeah, we have just about a minute left. I think that's a really important point you made about the economy still being largely in private hands, right? I mean, a lot of the country's wealth has been sort of reclaimed by the public over the past 20 years of Bolivarian Revolution. But, you know, if we just think about the goods that are subject to the worst inflation in Venezuela. So here's some statistics. The private sector controls 50% of production and distribution of food. For personal hygiene items, that's 80%. For pharmaceutical items, that's 70%. For clothes and shoes, 80% of that is in the hands of private corporations. So, I mean, it's the private sector of the economy that's essentially staged a capital strike to try to, you know, for political purposes, which is something they did in 2003, 2004 as well. I mean, all of this we've seen before. We have just about 30 seconds left. It seems like there's a danger of a real war, even if it's not, you know, it doesn't seem inevitable at all. But, you know, that seems to be being worked on.
Yes. Again, I have to look at the way this administration and our media is demonizing Maduro as an evil dictator. But at the same time, we have Donald Trump in North Korea giving all this fawning praise to Kim Jong-un. And the same people are pretty much ignoring what's going on in Pakistan and India. And we have a government that is led by a party and includes a so-called opposition party that really is not governing. They're following their self-interest, and the world is really, really suffering because of that.
Okay, I think we'll leave it right there. We were joined from Washington by Jackie Lukman. She's the co-editor-in-chief of Lukman Nation. Check out their live stream every week on Facebook and YouTube. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
And clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
It's Wednesday, so we're going to continue our regular segment Beyond Nuclear, where we look at nuclear issues, including weapons, energy, waste, and the future of nuclear technology in the United States. We're joined in studio by Kevin Camps. He is the radioactive waste watchdog at the organization Beyond Nuclear. And we're joined in studio by Sputnik News analyst and producer Nicole Roussel. Welcome back. Thanks.
Thank you.
So, Kevin, let's start with Diablo Canyon. You've been on the road doing some work on this issue. Tell us all about the latest.
Well, I got invited out by a panel. Pacific Gas and Electric is the owner of Diablo Canyon Nuclear Power Plant, two large-size nuclear reactors, which thankfully have a shutdown date of 2024 and 2025.
Hooray.
The first nuclear plant in the country not to seek a 20-year license extension on top of its first 40 years. That means several more years of reactor risks. But what this panel was all about was the radioactive waste risks at Diablo Canyon and the San Luis Obispo Mothers for Peace, a 50-year-old organization that began as an anti-Vietnam War group and then moved into anti-Diablo, anti-nuclear work decades ago, really, wanted me out there on this panel. And what took place was you had the vendors, the companies that make high-level radioactive waste storage containers trying to sell their wares to Pacific Gas and Electric with a lot of community concern out there. So you had Holtec, which is behind the New Mexico dump that we talk about on the show a lot. But you also had a German company called GNS, which is infamous in Germany for the Gorleben centralized interim storage facility, which generated some of the biggest protests in post-World War II history in Germany, but actually led to the German nuclear power phase-out. That was the heartbeat of the German anti-nuclear movement, was protesting these shipments into Gorleben on the old border between East and West. And you had other companies too. You had Nuclear Assurance Corporation and others. They were all trying to sell their products for use at Diablo. And one of the pieces of bad news is that PG&E at this point, and we pushed hard against this, wants to keep their high-level radioactive waste storage pool packed to the gills at Diablo Canyon until the year 2032. And they were doing acrobatics to explain why this was a good idea. It's a bad idea. If the pool loses its cooling water, you could have a radioactive waste fire. And if so much waste is in the pool, it's going to make the fire more likely, and it's going to make the consequences even worse.
Let's go back for a second to some of the companies that were there. So are there any companies that are actually making storage casks that are appropriate, that are safe, that are something that you would advocate using? It's a little wild to me that there are companies that have profit incentives who are the ones making these, as opposed to regulators or, people who actually know the real specifications and have the people's interests in mind. But are there any even available that you saw?
There are problems with all the cask models throughout the world, but I will point out that it is true that the United States is the worst in the world in a big way. The use of thin-walled containers in the United States, as thin as a half-inch thick inner canisters that actually hold the waste, and then there's additional layers put in on top of that for neutron shielding, gamma shielding, structural integrity, all that stuff. But in Germany, for example, the company GNS makes a castor, which is 16 inches thick. So that's 32 times as thick as the American models in terms of the inner canister in the American models. But that German cask does have some extra layers too, some concrete around it, for one thing, against a missile attack, for example. So the concrete would absorb the missile attack, but if the attacker showed up with two missiles, then they could go after that 16-inch thick wall. And in fact, there was a study done at U.S. Aberdeen Proving Ground, U.S. Army, in 1998 that showed that this German model was vulnerable to anti-tank weapons that are obsolete now, that are 40 years old. It blew a hole as big around as a grapefruit. And if you combine that through wall breach with a fire, which attackers could do by including an incendiary weapon, you could release the contents, at least the cesium-137, which is highly volatile and highly biologically hazardous. So to answer your question, no. And that's why since 2002, we've been calling for hardened on-site storage as close as possible to the point of generation, which means taking into account things like terrorist attacks, which again, the U.S. is so much worse than Germany. In Germany, they require fortified buildings around the dry cask storage.
Oh.
In the U.S., they line them up like bowling pins, and they're out in plain sight. They're out in the open. It's all to save money. That's the driving motivation in the United States. Get away with as little as you can.
What about earthquakes? There are, a lot of earthquakes in California. There's, always the fear of the big one, quote unquote, coming.
And fires.
Yeah. And does that also play a role in sort of the overall safety assessment, the risks that posed by the Diablo Canyon reactor?
PG&E is bankrupt now. And a big part of that is because they are implicated in the Camp Fire, where scores of people were killed. And they're facing huge damage lawsuits now. And so they declared bankruptcy, which is kind of scary. Now you've got an operating nuclear power plant with a lot of radioactive waste on site. They also own and control the Humboldt Bay nuclear power plant, long closed, but radioactive waste on site. Both of these sites, Diablo Canyon in San Luis Obispo, Humboldt Bay way up north near the Redwoods, are on earthquake fault lines, very close to the San Andreas. But at Diablo Canyon, you've got more than a dozen fault lines in the immediate vicinity, two of them major. And that's why, you know, several more years of reactor operations are a problem. You can still have meltdowns at those reactors, and then the radioactive waste as well. So if you listen to Holtec, which actually already has a contract with PG&E, they have a certain number of containers, more than 50, deployed at Diablo Canyon, which is a lot of waste already. And these vendors were trying to get the next round of contract up there. So they would claim that they've taken earthquakes into consideration, but we would question that. I mean, something about Holtec, and this again is the company that wants to store all the waste in the country in southeastern New Mexico, they just had a very serious near drop of a 50-ton inner canister loaded with waste down south in California, San Onofre, right on the edge of the Pacific, 100 feet from the Pacific Ocean. They nearly dropped one of these containers. And what that would have looked like, it would have dropped 18 feet. It would have been a very impactful collision because it's a 50-ton weight hitting a concrete floor. And they tried to cover it up. And a whistleblower came forward and said, hey, everybody, I need to tell you about what just happened. He lost his job. So this crooked company needs to be watched at every step.
Man, that is completely outrageous. I mean, that's a huge risk that just happened at San Onofre.
And we've known since the year, I've known since January of 2003, even though it goes back further than that, that whistleblowers again, thank God for whistleblowers, revealed that the Holtec containers are designed and manufactured in a very dubious manner. So there's major quality assurance violations. They've got unqualified personnel doing the work. They're using shoddy materials. They're actually, in one example, they are accelerating the cooling of welding, which introduces brittleness. So if all that's going on, and I believe it probably still is, and you drop one of these things 18 feet and that 50 tons hits an immovable object like a concrete floor, will those welds hold up? And if they don't, now you have a pathway for release of high-level radioactive waste into the environment.
And in this case, into the Pacific Ocean, which is like pretty awful.
It shows how out of control things are that Southern California Edison at San Onofre down between San Diego and LA is allowed by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to put dry cast storage of high-level radioactive waste 108 feet from the Pacific Ocean and mere inches above current sea level at high tide with rising seas.
We're not even putting houses in those scenarios. Why would we put such extremely dangerous waste?
And what I've pointed out, instead of moving that waste at San Onofre 1,000 miles to the east to the New Mexico-Texas borderlands, how about moving it 5 miles or less to the east, deeper into the heart of Camp Pendleton Marine Corps Base, on which the San Onofre Nuclear Power Plant is located anyway? You'd get it out of the tsunami zone, out of the earthquake zone, away from rising seas. And the added bonus is you'd have the greatest concentration of U.S. Marines in the lower 48 to help guard it.
And what happens to a large body of water when it becomes irradiated, both in terms of the human cost and in terms of the economic cost of that?
So, for example, what they're facing at San Onofre on the Pacific coast right now, we've been facing in Michigan on the Lake Michigan shoreline for a quarter century because the Palisades nuclear power plant put its high-level radioactive waste dry casks about 150 yards from the water of Lake Michigan, which is drinking water supply for 40 million people in the U.S., in Canada, and a large number of Native American nations downstream. You know, the Pacific Ocean is a bigger volume of water. People don't drink it, but they do eat the seafood from there. In the Great Lakes, people drink that water and eat the fish from the Great Lakes, and the water's used for irrigation on crops. So if you get radioactivity into water, it's going to enter the drinking water supply in the Great Lakes. It's going to enter the seafood supply in the Pacific, and it bioconcentrates in the food chain. It works its way up to higher concentration levels, higher up the food chain. We're at the top of the food chain. It's very bad news for human health.
Let's go back to Diablo Canyon for a moment. I just want to hear, you know, we've concentrated on what some of the really negative aspects are of what's going on there. But I know that there's, as always, a very big movement afoot that's really pushing back against this sort of really problematic and structural problems that they're trying to even make worse with storing waste so poorly. What is Beyond Nuclear doing? What are you doing? What are others in California doing? And what are the demands of the people who are pushing back against this?
Well, the San Luis Obispo Mothers for Peace have been the watchdogs, one of the watchdog groups for decades on Diablo Canyon. And in fact, where Seabrook, New Hampshire was the birth of the U.S. anti-nuclear movement, anti-nuclear power in New Hampshire in the east, out at Diablo Canyon, just a few years behind Seabrook, that was the western end of the birth of the U.S. anti-nuclear power movement. So folks have been fighting it forever, and it was part of what led to, several years ago, an agreement between the utility, Pacific Gas and Electric, and environmental groups like Friends of the Earth and Alliance for Nuclear Responsibility and the labor unions involved and even the municipalities that host the nuclear plant for a shutdown. No license extension. And how are we going to replace, 2,000 megawatts of electricity with renewables is the good news. The bankruptcy has thrown a monkey wrench into things to some extent, but hopefully we're praying that that shutdown agreement holds or is accelerated. I mean, a bankrupt nuclear power plant should probably be shut down as soon as possible. And the advantage of that is once the fuel comes out of the core, no more meltdown possibility, but the risk moves into the pool. So get the pools emptied as soon as possible. Secure them in all kinds of ways against earthquakes, against terrorist attacks, against leaks. And so that's the challenge that we all face.
Those seem like pretty decent and basic demands. I support them, Kevin, for what it's worth. If people want to get involved in what's going on with Beyond Nuclear, is there information about Diablo Canyon on Beyond Nuclear's website, beyondnuclear.org?
Yeah, because I just got back, I'm going to put it at the top of beyondnuclear.org, an update on the Diablo Canyon situation, which again is good news. We've blocked the license extension as a movement, but we would love to shut them down as soon as possible and secure the waste.
While we're out west in the U.S., are there updates on what's going on with Holtec in New Mexico with the massive dump that they're trying to get moving?
Yeah, I mean, the legal battle goes on a weekly and sometimes daily basis. So the attorneys for a coalition of environmental groups, a month after we had hearings before the Nuclear Regulatory Commission Licensing Board in Albuquerque, have introduced new contentions or amended old contentions based on admissions that Holtec made out there a month ago. And one of the admissions that Holtec's top lawyer based at Pillsbury in your neighborhood, Jay Silberg, made that day was that, well, yes, indeed, this proposal for the Department of Energy to take title and liability for the waste out here, pay all the bills, including a handsome profit to Holtec International, that happens to be illegal under the law. But he hastened to add that Congress could change that. And believe you me, Holtec's lobbyists are working the Hill as we speak every day to try to get the law changed to make it okay for DOE to take title out there. Right now, DOE can only take title to this commercial high-level radioactive waste at a licensed and operating permanent repository. And this Holtec centralized interim storage facility is not that. Although it begs the question, so once it gets out to southeast New Mexico or the sister project waste control specialists over in Texas, 40 miles away, it's going to stay there permanently? Is that what you're admitting? And that's a real risk. Another risk is that they might want to reprocess the waste. They've said this to certain audiences. And then in the license applications right now, they're silent about it. But reprocessing is the worst thing you can do with high-level radioactive waste. You have massive releases to the atmosphere, massive releases to surface water. And there's a very significant risk of nuclear weapons proliferation. When you pull weapons-grade plutonium out of commercial high-level radioactive waste, you can use it for weapons if you choose to, or whoever gets a hold of it. Separated plutonium is weapons usable.
Well, we had done about half of our segment now, and there are so many conversations and conferences and conflicts kind of going on worldwide right now. Let's move to some of the nuclear weapons conversations that are happening. So let's start with India and Pakistan. There's been a bunch of developments this week. Do you want to tell us what's been going on?
Well, I mean, it started with a purported terrorist attack, an explosion, a suicide bomber that killed 40 Indian paramilitaries in the Kashmir region on Valentine's Day. And since that time, there have been multiple Indian airstrikes in not only in the Kashmir disputed territory, but in Pakistan proper, I believe it's fair to say. And then Pakistan has responded in kind. There have been downed planes, Indian pilots have been taken prisoner, and what's really alarming, besides the military escalation, is that both countries are nuclear armed for the past 20 years. India's been nuclear armed since the mid-1970s, thanks to U.S. and Canadian help in that regard under Atoms for Peace. That's where India got its nuclear weapons capability. But Pakistan, too, has been helped by the U.S. For example, Pakistan, for a time, had nuclear weapons production capability and even nuclear weapons, but they didn't have a delivery mechanism until the George H.W. Bush administration sold them a squadron of F-16 fighter jets, which are nuclear bomber capable. And a CIA whistleblower who then had moved to the Pentagon tried to raise the alarms about this. We're about to sell Pakistan the ability to deliver its nuclear warheads. And his life was, his career anyway, was ruined in response to, you know, telling the truth, essentially. So here we are with the Pakistan Nuclear Decision-Making Committee meeting as we speak in the past day or two. I don't know that that had happened before in a real life scenario. So that's the risk is, as we've talked about in the past on the show, if as few as 100 Nagasaki-sized bombs are exchanged between India and Pakistan, it could induce a nuclear winter on planet Earth that starves 2 billion people.
Yeah, I mean, it's unbelievably dangerous. I mean, just to give our listeners a little bit of background to the conflict that we're talking about, the territorial dispute between India and Pakistan over control of Kashmir, which is a highly mountainous region. It's quite large. And right now it's divided along what's called the line of control. Both sides still claim, you know, moral or political right to control the whole territory, but there is a de facto partition. You know, all of South Asia, the Indian subcontinent, was basically one British colony prior to decolonization in 1947. But the Western powers wanted there to basically not be one big country that comes out of that process of decolonization. And so there was a partition in 1947 where Pakistan, which at the time also included Bangladesh, which at that time was referred to as East Pakistan, fought a war with India over control of, you know, well, basically how would the two countries divide up the territory of the Indian subcontinent? And religion had to do with this as well. The leader of the Pakistan independence movement was the leader of a political party called the Pakistan Muslim League. And so that devastating conflict basically led to an arrangement where, you know, Kashmir, which was led at the time by a prince, would sort of join the former UK colony that became India. And then Pakistan moved in and tried to assert control over what it could before that transfer of authority took place. Since that time, there had been a number of really, really devastating conflicts between the two countries. One was in 1965. There was another one, I think, in 1999 called the Kargil War. You know, thousands of people died in these conflicts. But now with the introduction of nuclear weapons, and Kevin laid out the history of how those two countries got a hold of them, it sort of takes on this new dimension. It becomes a potentially world-ending conflict. It's hard to overstate the existential threat posed to humanity by the existence of these weapons, both in India and Pakistan and everywhere else.
Right. And, you know, with the U.S. and Russia and other countries still really basing their national security, their military strategy on nuclear weapons, we have, you know, that bad example set for the world. And so more and more countries, it's fair to say, as time goes on, see that as maybe the way to go. So the most recent entrant to the nuclear weapons club is North Korea. So we have all these hotspots in the world where adversaries on either side of a divide are armed with nuclear weapons. And the chance of accidental initiation of a nuclear war, of a misjudgment, a miscalculation, and then it's getting worse, incredibly. So the U.S., as we speak, is now rolling out these new usable, small-yield, low-yield nuclear weapons to be deployed on submarines and fired by missiles.
But they're smaller, Kevin, so it's fine, right?
Well, it could, you know, the spark could turn into a wildfire is the thing. And some people say, well, you know, it's just a small nuke. It wouldn't escalate to hydrogen bombs. But one problem is that the missiles used, they could be a hydrogen bomb on the tip or one of these low yield, and the adversary receiving the blow, are they supposed to wait until they see the size of the mushroom cloud before responding? Probably they won't wait, and they may retaliate with hydrogen bombs in response to a low-yield nuclear attack.
Well, also, if the escalation ladder has already gotten into small nuclear bombs, like the escalation, you're already pretty high on the escalation ladder. Like, let's not get there in the first place. And once, you know, once someone does get there, what's stopping them from going even higher, right? Like, this is just a very bad place for any of these countries to be. You know, you mentioned the U.S. And Russia, and there's new updates that you've sent us about the new START treaty that was signed by Barack Obama in 2010. And now it needs to be renewed at some point coming up soon. There are some people that are pushing Trump to sign the New START treaty, but to also include all nuclear weapons within the New START treaty, as opposed to just some selected weapons that are currently in it. Air Force General John Hyten, who's commander of U.S. Strategic Command, specifically has been offering public opinions about this, that really every nuclear weapon needs to be included in these. And especially given that the U.S. pulled out of a treaty with Russia, the INF treaty, not too long ago. I couldn't agree more, honestly, with this commander. It's a little bit surprising, potentially, coming from the military. But tell us your thoughts on this new compromise and hopefully this new extension of this treaty.
Well, General Hyten's words were welcome in my mind. It's a great change at Strategic Air Command, because back on Hiroshima Day, August 6th of 2003, I believe, under the George W. Bush and Cheney administration, Strategic Air Command hosted a conference on usable nuclear weapons, promoting it. So I'm glad that SAC has a different position now, and at least in the regard of trying to not only renew the New START treaty and extend it for 5 years beyond 2020, but to expand it to other nuclear weapons, to include all nuclear weapons, actually. So we're at this incredible crossroads where Trump apparently would have all nuclear arms control treaties done away with, and it would be like we were back in the year 1972, before there were any limits on U.S. and, at the time, Soviet, now Russian, nuclear weaponry. And then you have Hyten just the other day saying, no, we should extend New START and we should expand it. And I would hope that would include other countries too, not just the U.S. and Russia, but China, all the nuclear weapons powers. That's, of course, the way to go. And I just saw some good news walking in the door here that South Africa has ratified the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. So we are inching forward towards the 50 countries needed to pass this treaty into international law that would abolish nuclear weapons and leave other countries not willing to, like the U.S. and Russia, as rogues internationally.
Can you tell us a little bit more about that treaty? You know, when did it start? Who signed on so far broadly? How many more countries do we need? And also, you know, what would you see as the consequences for the U.S.? I mean, the U.S. has, you know, for decades just either not signed things or signed things and said that they'll do things but not done them. And there haven't been consequences. For example, the non-proliferation treaty, there have been no consequences for the U.S. continuing to build more weapons. So if this treaty does get signed, which sounds like it's possible and that's great news, what does that actually mean for these rogue countries? Will they hopefully see some sort of punishment or consequences from the rest of the world?
Well, the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons took a huge step forward in July of 2017 when the better part of 100 countries signed on to it. But that's the very first step. And leadership came from places like Austria. It was a manifestation of the non-nuclear weapon states really angry at decades of delay by the nuclear weapon state to take any meaningful action on the abolition of nuclear weapons. And so July 2017, 100 countries said, yes, this is a good idea, but now those countries have to ratify it in their parliaments. And we're about two dozen countries into that. We need twice that. We need 50 countries, and then it becomes international law. And I think, truth be told, I mean, you know, the U.S. will defend its sovereignty. The U.N. can't tell us what to do. Well, and they did that in July 2017. It was actually Nikki Haley who organized the nuclear weapons countries to protest this treaty. This is a really bad idea. And she went so far as to say, I'm a mother of young children, and I feel more secure knowing that the U.S. has nuclear weapons to defend my children. It was along those lines. You know, with the Nobel Peace Prize a year ago, given to ICAN, the International Campaign for the Abolition of Nuclear Weapons, that was at least the Peace Prize Committee saying, hey, no, this is a new day. We need to make this happen. Before the Hibakusha are gone to warn the world, because even the babies from Hibakusha and Nagasaki are now old people, you know? And so they're going to leave the scene. And who's going to warn humanity about what it means to live through, if you're lucky enough, a nuclear attack?
Can you just explain who the Hibakusha are?
The Hibakusha are the Japanese survivors of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And they shared in the Nobel Peace Prize.
Right, because, you know, there were like about 100,000 people who were instantly vaporized, I believe, and then several hundred thousand more who later developed cancer that they wouldn't have otherwise, you know, developed and passed away that way. And then there were people who survived the radiation. Yeah, I mean, it's really remarkable. So there's one other international agreement that's really crucial when it comes to nuclear weapons, that's the NPT, the non proliferation treaty. And, you know, it actually does also contain the affirmative obligation to disarm. That's sort of the deal, right? So the countries that signed the NPT are saying we will not seek to develop nuclear weapons. And in return, the countries that already do have nuclear weapons have an obligation to disarm, right? It's just that the modality by which that disarmament would take place was left, you know, not described in the NPT. India and Pakistan, the two countries who we were just talking about, neither of them are signatories to the Non-Proliferation Treaty. So it's not something that is sort of universal that covers the entire world. And yet, you know, everybody in the whole world obviously has an interest in seeking the abolition of these nuclear weapons because it poses, you know, it poses the threat of the end of life on Earth or the end of human civilization on Earth. What needs to happen for these, you know, legal obligations that the nuclear powers have to follow through on what international law says they must do?
Israel is also a non-signatory. North Korea had been a signatory and withdrew, which was their right, and they did, unfortunately. So, yes, I mean, this treaty on the prohibition of nuclear weapons is really a calling of the bluff. It's, you know, I'm about to turn 50, and I was born the same year as the Non-Proliferation Treaty in 1969. 50 years is enough of playing around with these games. As more and more countries are gaining nuclear arms, taking that decision to do that. So, unfortunately, the United States has been playing with fire, has been dealing with the devil, Faustian fission, for a very long time. And one example of that that's so shameful was the U.S.-India nuclear commerce deal under the George W. Bush administration, although a lot of Democrats in Congress went along with this. What it was an exemption from U.S. law that says we can't do nuclear power commerce with a country that hasn't even bothered to sign the Non-Proliferation Treaty. But they made a major exemption for India, which kind of angered Pakistan, which was not offered such an exemption. And so Pakistan then turned to China for nuclear commerce. And so one story that I picked up from a local DC Indian publication that is available for free in Indian restaurants, you just pick it up and read it, was a description of how Indian families in the United States had just given major campaign contributions to George W. Bush, urging him to make this India U.S. nuclear commerce deal happen. And guess what? He did. And then he invited them to a state dinner at the White House so they could celebrate this great accomplishment. And all it does is it normalizes rogue behavior, like not signing the Non-Proliferation Treaty and then trusting the Indian government not to use this nuclear technology, supposedly the peaceful atom, for nuclear weapons purposes when they already had. Back in 1974, they took U.S. reprocessing technology, plutonium extraction technology. They took Canadian reactor technology, and they exploded their first nuclear weapon, which they codenamed Smiling Buddha in 1974 under Indira Gandhi. And guess what? India is now a nuclear weapons power. And the way Pakistan got there, again, through nuclear power technology, was Abdul Qadir Khan, AQ Khan, worked for a uranium enrichment corporation in the Netherlands and didn't show up one Monday morning, had taken the blueprints for uranium enrichment centrifuge technology back to Pakistan with him, the birth of the Pakistani nuclear weapons program. That's how nuclear power can lead to nuclear weapons.
Well, we're going to have to leave it right there. We were joined in studio by Kevin Camps. He is the nuclear waste watchdog at the organization Beyond Nuclear. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 a.m. in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, and Spotify. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. Stay tuned to Radio Sputnik.
Loud and clear.